When did you start bringing everything downstairs, just so you don't have to go back upstairs again? Joint Relief Institute. Move better, live better without surgery. Call 708-888-0000.
Dr. Joni Johnston, the criminal mind. We talk about it. True crime is one of the most popular genres in movies, in books, in documentaries. And my next guest is one of the best educated and the most highly experienced experts in this field. She's a clinical and forensic psychologist, the author of several books, including Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. She's also, of all things, a private investigator and the host of a popular YouTube channel, Unmasking a Murder. She's also a risk assessor for the California Board of Parole. Welcome to the show, Dr. Johnston. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure, Karen. I've been looking forward to it.
You know, we met at a crime convention in New Mexico, and we hit it off. And it was an interesting place where hundreds of people were gathered to listen to people talk about serial killers and not only that, but victims' rights and dog search teams and investigations. And so it was kind of a diverse group of people. But it's so clear that people are obsessed with true crime. Is there something healthy about this from a psychological standpoint?
Well, I think it can become unhealthy, but I think there are a couple of things to think about. One is we've always been obsessed with true crime. You know, people oftentimes think this is a new phenomenon, and I think certainly it's taken off in the media and those kinds of things. But, you know, looking at you know, 200 years ago, or even, you know, people used to bring picnics to go watch public hangings.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
those were the days.
Backdrop, you know, like, yeah, that, you know, that there's always been this interest in courts and true crime. And I think that the motivation for that, when we know that the audience for true crime is about 70% women, and I think there's a reason for that. I think that there's, I don't think we're just interested in the gore or even primarily interested in that. I think it's, in some respects, I think for a lot of women, it's like our brain running the fire drills for a threat. You know, it's like, you know, we're watching these shows, we're seeing these things happen, and we're trying to figure out who, you know, what, when, where, how, and how could I escape this? How could I figure this person out ahead of time?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be that victim.
And I think, you know, so instead of feeling less safe by watching all this creepy stuff, there might be an idea that you're protecting yourself and you're saying, hey, that's not going to be me because I'm going to know when that guy starts asking me to come into the pickup truck and he's got an axe in his hand. You know, I'm just exaggerating. But how did you get your start, Dr. Johnston? I know that you were very young when you took an interest in true crime.
I really was. I came from a family of true crime viewers. My mom was an avid true crime fan. We watched every detective show on TV. And then when I was 14 on a family vacation, I picked up the book Helter Skelter. And I just could not get my head around that book. And so that, I think, turned me into, from a true crime fan into a budding forensic psychologist.
And for those who haven't read it or seen the movie, you know, it's about Charles Manson. It's a great job. Bugliosi, who was a prosecutor in that case, so it was really, he did a great job of writing. And, you know, I had a parallel experience. I don't, Patrick, you're probably way more normal than us. But
no, I doubt it.
I read In Cold Blood, and I just thought, you know, Truman Capote's masterpiece. It was great. Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore, who was executed, and Stranger Beside Me was one of my favorites. That was by Anne Rule about her experience working a rape hotline with Ted Bundy. That was just a great book. So let's talk a little bit, Dr. Johnston, about the exact formula for the creation of a serial killer. We don't know what it is, but what are some of the elements that you see when you're doing these kinds of analysis or, looking at trying to figure out who might be a perpetrator? What are the elements you see?
It's almost like a recipe, I think. And obviously, it varies from person to person, but we do see these common ingredients. You know, one being, of course, abuse or trauma in childhood. About 68% of serial killers were abused as children. So that's about six times the general population. But, of course, that means a third were not. So clearly, trauma and abuse is not destiny. And we know that most people who have horrendous childhoods do never hurt anybody else. As a matter of fact, they may be the ones who are least likely hurt other people. But we do see this obviously an overrepresentation of trauma and abuse in childhood. We oftentimes see these genetic predispositions to a lack of empathy, impulsivity. So there's certainly some biological or temperamental I think, predisposition as well. So you have these two in combination with each other. And then I think you have this life course. And I think depending upon what happens in that person's life, you can get this kind of, you know, this terrible ingredients that end up baking this, you know, serial killer cake, if you will.
Right. And you know, what is the role of fantasy? Because I hear and I read that at an early age, a lot of these serial killers have fantasies that involve violence and sex, which is a strange combination to the average person. How does that happen in a person's mind where they are interested in these kinds of things?
We certainly find that, Karen, in sexually motivated serial killers. I mean, I think it's important to obviously remember that we're not all serial killers are sexually motivated, but the ones that we hear about and know about, like Ted Bundy, like Richard Ramirez, like John Wayne Gacy, are sexually motivated. And we know that between the ages of 11 and 15, oftentimes these individuals or these children basically get exposed either to inappropriate sex, violence and sex get fused. Maybe they're witnessing a lot of domestic violence. Maybe they're exposed to violent pornography. But sometime in that period of time, there is this kind of, which is when sexual interest begins to develop for all of us, there is this kind of glitch that happens or this terrible experience that happens to them. And so this fantasy starts because this we know that a lot of our sexual interests are, you know, start relatively young in that young adolescent age. And oftentimes it's our first experiences that will kind of shape that. And so you have this fusion of sex and violence that can, again, occur in a bunch of different ways. And then that starts the fantasy rolling.
Do you think, I mean, in this, I don't think anyone has a definitive answer, but in your heart of hearts, do you think that, let's just say you caught somebody at the age of 14 or 15 and you knew that they were having sexual, violent, fantasies. Is there a way from a psychological standpoint to put a stop to that, to prevent somebody from becoming a serial killer? What is your best, assessment of that?
Well, we certainly can intervene in almost any child until they hit a certain age and have certain experiences and develop certain kind of proclivities that are kind of that are exercised over and over again. So we're not very good at predicting who's going to become a serial killer. We can't do it, as you pointed out. We just can't. But what we can do is treat the child in front of us. And so when we have a child who is exhibiting cruelty to animals, or we have a child who is, you know, engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior or exhibiting conduct problems, are effective treatments for all of those as long as we catch them early enough and intervene enough.
And I suppose that goes for kids who are going to be school shooters, where they're, again, having fantasies about doing these horrible things, and they may have a genetic predisposition, and they may have had, you know, abuse as a kid or bullying and those types of things. And you would hope that you'd be able to intervene when you see that kind of, when you see the writing on the wall there. Before we take a break, we're here with Dr. Joni Johnston. She is a clinical and forensic psychologist. She has a free Substack newsletter, The Mind Detective, and this book, which is fabulous. I started reading it. Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. Really, really well done and quick moving is the kind of thing that, you know, you may not want to go to sleep after reading it, but you're certainly going to be interested in it. Tell us what the McDonald Triad is in the area of serial killers, and is it really a science, and is it proven to be true?
McDonald Triad was developed by a man named McDonald, no surprise there, in the 1960s, and it consists of three things: bedwetting, or I guess beyond what we would call the normal level, you know, the normal range, fire setting, and animal cruelty. And this got a lot of buzz when it came out. And, you know, he himself in 1984 came out and said, I don't really think there's a correlation between serial murder and this McDonald Triad. But everybody kind of ignored that. The answer really is no. It has not been borne out by research. We know that, for example, animal cruelty over the age of 6, certainly that's premeditated and directed toward a pet, is a hallmark for later antisocial behavior. You know, when a kid is star setting, you know, that's certainly over the age of 6. Also, we certainly see that can lead to or there's some correlation there. But this idea, what it tends to really say, Karen, is there's some trauma that's gone on or something is going on in this child's house. So if the McDonald Triad is a marker for anything, it's a marker for some kind of something is wrong.
Right.
as opposed to this is going to become a serial killer.
Dr. Johnston, before we get to your risk assessment that you do for the California Parole Board, I have a nice texter from the 708 area code. Ask the guest how she distinguishes if someone is a psychopath or a sociopath. That's a really good question, Doctor, because I think people use those terms interchangeably. And can you explain the difference between the two?
I can, and that really is an interesting question. I think a lot of even professionals struggle with that at times. So, you know, psychopath was only recently introduced into our kind of mental health Bible, if you will. Sociopathy. So let me just kind of give a short answer and then I can elaborate. The short answer is that, at least in theory, sociopathy, the symptoms are relatively similar, but in sociopathy, it tends to be environmentally produced. So in other words, you have a child who's born neurotypical. This is a child who's, you know, like everybody else, and his childhood is so traumatic, or so deviant that it's almost like the empathy that he had kind of gets beaten out of him, just to be blunt, you know, or just gets socialized out of him. And that's where the social part of it, the sociopathy. Psychopathy it tends to be more biologically based or have a genetic predisposition to it. Now, when I say it's not that somebody is born a psychopath, but we can sometimes see children, the research calls them callous, unemotional traits. And these children, where you'll see children from an early age who don't seem to have the same emotional sensitivity. There's like, it's almost like they have an emotional deficit. They don't recognize fear. They don't demonstrate fear. They don't learn as much from punishment. There's something, you know, you'll have a kid on the playground, for example, when somebody falls down and starts crying, kids are running to help, and this kid thinks it's funny and doesn't really understand why other kids are concerned about this. So you'll see those kinds of genetic predispositions or markers. And that just means, again, it doesn't mean this person is going to turn out to be a psychopath or do bad things, but this person has a genetic, like, almost like an emotional deficit.
Yeah, like a chip missing.
Exactly.
Let's pivot a little bit to the California Parole Board. You are involved in making assessments to give recommendations to the parole board as to whether to release people on parole. I'm going to just kind of use really broad terms here. I'm sure it's much more complicated than that. But tell us how you go about talking to people, interviewing people, giving them tests, and assessing whether you think someone may recommit if they are released.
Yeah, it is, as you can imagine, Carrie, a lot more complicated than just trying to get, but it is, and we don't have crystal ball, unfortunately, as evidenced by the fact that we know that there have been people who have been released and then, you know, done horrible things. But I do think we have some pretty good research, at least in terms of predicting on a group level. And, you know, so what I do, of course, is not do anything until I have that person's full history. And that just means I know everything they did before they came to prison. I know if they've been on parole before. I know how they did on parole before. And I know how they've done when they're in prison. And so I always take that information into account. That's very important to be able to, because, you know, the person who I'm interviewing has a vested interest in appearing to be a certain way, right? I don't hold that against this person, but neither am I going to trust what they say, you know, without checking. And so I'm looking at that person's background, and I often use structured assessments, you know, again, based on the research. So, for example, we know that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Certainly past similar behavior. So, you know, I'm going to look at this person's violence history. How violent has this person been? Who is he violent toward? How many times has he been violent? So I'm going to look at all those factors. I'm going to be looking at what kind of programming he's done in prison, what other people have said about him, what kind of treatment he's had. I'm going to be looking at what he's going to be doing if he gets out, what kind of protective factors does he have outside, what kind of, you know, parole recommendations, what kind of parole specifications are going to be on this person. One of the things I'm not going to be looking at, because people talk about this all the time, is, you know, this person's diagnosis, because we know it has nothing to do or very, very little to do with violence. About 4% of violence tends to be caused by mental illness. But if somebody does have a serious mental illness, I'm going to be looking at, do they take their medication? What is their history of doing that? How compliant are they? What kind of symptoms do they have when they're off of it? We know that certain symptoms, like command auditory hallucinations, is linked to violence, or paranoid ideation. So I'm looking at all those things and trying to put together some kind of assessment, not only in terms of is this person safe to be released, but under what conditions would they be safe and what would they need, what kind of structure in the community would they need to help them be safe.
Patrick, you have a question for the doctor.
Yeah, and this is, Doctor, you've written and talked about and so many different things in so many different areas, but one of the things we've written a lot about are staged suicides and how to determine, whether a murder is actually a staged suicide. And those are very common things. And I know that you've, researched a lot of those scenarios in terms of staged suicides to determine whether a suicide was actually staged and in fact was a murder. Is there, and we've all read books, there's a lot of TV shows and movies, and we look at folks and watch folks look at that scene to determine whether that quote unquote suicide is actually a murder. Is there, to a trained eye, like yourself, are there certain tells? Like when you watch a show, do you know immediately, whether that person is actually murdered and wasn't the victim of killing themselves?
When I watch a show.
Well, when you read a book, I just want to know what the tells are. Well, because I can look at it and see hey, I don't know, it looks like a suicide to me,
There's probably a lot that goes into this, but and is it fair to say that there are about 120 times that you've been hired and you've come to the conclusion that it was a murder, not a suicide? Is that a fair statement of the facts?
Fair statement might be. I've collected so far about 165 cases.
Okay.
Of people who have been, and these are adjudicated cases. So these are not just my opinion, right? Oh, I think this is really a murder. These are people who have been convicted. And oftentimes it was initially ruled a suicide. I think it's a great question, Patrick, and I think there's really two things. I mean, obviously, you have to look at the evidence, right, the physical evidence at the scene. So in this research that I've done, we know, for example, about 75% of the time, the perpetrator in the situations where it really is a murder is the person who finds, the victim. We know that it's primarily 75% of the time it is an infant partner homicide. So about a third of the time, about a quarter of the time, it's not. But by far, most staged suicides are perpetrated by the intimate partner.
So we have about 1 minute here, and I don't want to give this short service here because this is really, really interesting. Can you just answer? Let's just answer a simple question, and on the other side of the news, let's flesh this out a little bit. The idea is that people come to you and they say, "My loved one could not possibly have committed suicide." But isn't it fair to say that most people don't assume that their friend, their loved one, is suicidal, and it's hard to accept? And do you see that a lot?
I see it. There's no doubt. I can also say, Karen, very quickly, that most people whose loved one committed suicide don't think they were murdered.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Very, very interesting.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Dr. Joni Johnston, she is the author of Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask, www.drjonijohnston.com. Thanks for hanging on with us. Let's focus on this area of your practice where you investigate alleged suicides and do an investigation to determine if it might in fact be murder, and you've been very successful in doing it. So let's start with who hires you.
Well, typically the family comes to me and they'll say that they, had a loved one who, died and the law enforcement closed it as a suicide and they don't believe that there's any way that the loved one committed suicide. And typically, I think this is something that's important, is they have a suspect. They know who they think did it. And it's oftentimes in the context of a domestic violence situation.
And
so it's not like they're just coming, because you made a really good point earlier, Karen, which is that, it's very difficult to accept that your loved one committed suicide, especially if you had no idea. And that does happen. So that's, I think, something that always piques my interest, is when people come and their loved one was in the context of a domestic violence situation, they were abused. maybe they're getting ready to leave, and all of a sudden that's this person dies. And, you know, the husband or the wife, is mainly the husband, is saying, oh, you know, she's been depressed forever, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right, which is not mutually exclusive, right? I mean, she could have been depressed because she was being domestically abused. So, you know, so what are the things you do, just briefly, you know, how do you investigate? What are the things you're looking at? Who are you speaking to? And then I want to ask you what you do with that information when you realize that perhaps the suicide is not the right assessment.
So I do two things. One is, of course, I get all the physical evidence. I get, you know, autopsy reports. I get all that. I'm not a medical doctor, so I have colleagues that I will sometimes refer out to. But it is important for me to see not only what the evidence says, but what was collected. You know, how was the crime scene handled? Who did they talk to at the crime scene? Who did they talk to since the thing happened? And then I do basically a psychological autopsy. I will get, you know, all medical records, mental health records as much as possible. I will get, I'll speak with, you know, depending on who it is, you know, parents, siblings, children. I'll speak with, you know, sometimes I'll speak with co-workers or, you know, a manager or supervisor. And what I'm looking for is just to see, you know, what other people thought about what's going on in this person's life. Because when you were talking to me earlier about, you know, don't you ever see people who their loved one did commit suicide and they can't accept it? And I said, yeah, I do. And I most often see that in situations where it is a parent and it's either an older teenager or young adult person who's died. And the parent maybe, you know, we think about who do those people talk to? They talk to their friends much more than their parents about what's really going on a lot of times. And I will then talk to their friends, and I'll find out that, yeah, this person was really depressed, and this person had made comments, but never to their parents. And so to the parents, but, you know, this was completely out of the blue. And so, I do this kind of complete kind of try to almost like a reconstruction. I look at them, you know, a couple of months before they die, do a timeline. And what I do is I'm not coming back and saying, yes, this person committed suicide. No, this person did not commit suicide. I'm saying based on the risk factors, based on the people I've talked to, based on the evidence that I've gathered from their medical records, what kind of risk was this person? How likely is it? And what alternative explanations make more sense if they do? And that's, I think, the biggest mistake I see law enforcement make sometimes. They go out to the crime scene. They have, you know, a husband there who's saying, my wife has been depressed, and I came home, and we got into an argument, and she hung herself. And they see a person who's got a rope around her neck. She's on the ground. They see a distraught spouse. I mean, they don't want to do an investigation. I mean, it's, you know, this person's traumatized. Look at how devastated the husband appears to be. And so pretty quickly, that can easily become a closed case. Without looking at other things, you know, without talking to other family members and verifying that. And the research I was talking about before the break, one of the other things that tells, I guess this is for Patrick, is over half the time the perpetrator said that the spouse had been depressed or had attempted suicide before, and that was backed up by 3% of family members. So when you see that kind of discrepancy, that's another kind of red flag that something else may be going on. So my recommendations are always to investigate further. It's never to, again, call it one way or the other or to recommend the medical examiner change their ruling. It's to say, this is what I'm thinking. This is my opinion based on, as a forensic psychologist and private investigator.
Doctor, during your investigation, do you talk to the person that the family believes actually murdered their family member?
I mean, typically that is impossible to do.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah,
I would think you would really want to, but I find that highly unlikely that they would agree to do that.
No,
have you ever had that happen, though?
No, I've never had that happen. I've never had that happen.
Interesting. So when you get this information, do you have a difficult time addressing law enforcement? Because, you know, law enforcement, you know, from what I know, you know, they get entrenched in their opinion. And the medical examiner made an assessment. The police made an assessment. They closed the case. It's done. And now they're going to have to change their minds if they listen to you. Is this a hard thing for you to do? How do you convince them to open up the investigation or to reconsider?
Well, it is incredibly hard to do. And so, you know, my communication is with the family. Right. So I give this report back to the family and they do with it what they can at that point. And typically that involves one of two things. They either go to the media more. Right. They're already in the media and try to put pressure in that way. Or they try to go around local law enforcement. They'll try to go to the prosecutor's office or they'll try to go to state. And they'll keep beating that drum until hopefully somebody, I mean, sometimes our report hopefully has an impact, you know, because I try to list, you know, these are the, I'm more of an objective person. I'm trying to list, you know, these are the things that concern me, because oftentimes I find evidence, I find information they don't have, because I've interviewed and gathered a lot more information than they were able to or chose to do. And so hopefully that is going to be another piece for them in terms of looking, you know, they never talk to the parents. They never talk to the best friends. You know, they don't know that this person, and there's a case that really got me started in this area of a young woman who committed, her death was ruled a suicide. She was 8 months pregnant. She could not wait to be a mother. The police came out, and there she is on the ground, and she's got a rope around her neck, and there again, there's her husband, and he's all distraught. He said that they had a big argument, and he went to the bathroom, take a bath. He came out, and she's hanging off the balcony. This case was closed for 24 years.
Wow. Wow. And was it, in fact, reopened?
Oh, it was reopened. This would take us 3 hours to go through, but the short answer is it was reopened when he committed arson many years later. And began kind of bonded with this detective who was investigating him for arson, and kind of started talking about his first wife who had died. He remarried, he had kids, who started kind of talking in this bizarre way. And this guy's like, what is this guy talking about his first wife for? And he got curious. And he went to this other police department and said, look, this guy just got arrested for arson. And he starts talking about his first wife and how she died, and she was pregnant. And he said, I don't understand this. And when he ends up exhuming her body, after
wow.
all this time, it was amazingly preserved, and they could still see a horizontal line around her neck. It looked clearly like a belt buckle. You could see it. You could see bruise on the back, like somebody had put his knee on her back. The signs were still there. They did a test. There was no way that the balcony rail would have held that weight. I mean, the evidence was there.
Interesting.
The suicide note was a poem she had written as a teenager.
Oh my gosh!
There's just all this information, and he ended up being convicted for her murder.
Oh. Wow. Good result. One of her niches is to investigate claimed suicides, and the idea being that they may, in fact, be a staged suicide and actually a murder. My partner, Patrick Dolan, is here, and he's got a question for you, Dr. Johnston. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I know we've looked at so many of these different scenarios in different locations. Do you find it more difficult to convince rural prosecutor's offices or detectives or police departments to actually reopen these matters and look closely at what you've found versus, you know, urban groups like that? Have you seen a distinction there?
I don't think, I can't really say that. I mean, intuitively, I can understand why you would ask that question. It seems to be, I think, the level of experience. As opposed to, I guess you would see some correlation there between rural versus urban.
I think
a lot of times it's almost like the psychological part of it in terms of not wanting to make a admit that I made a mistake or I didn't collect, you know, evidence that I should have or I didn't talk to people that I should have. I mean, that's just, you're talking to a psychologist, so maybe that's why I'm saying that. But
it seems
to be the biggest barrier.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess what I was thinking is, you know, they all sort of, in smaller communities, they know each other, prosecutors, defense attorneys, investigating bodies,
yeah.
who might be accused, or, you know, folks think have committed the crime. And so you've really got an uphill battle there because everybody sort of knows each other in smaller communities.
Well, I will tell you that I think I've definitely had more families call me initially who are from smaller communities. So that kind of speaks maybe to what you're talking about.
Yeah, the rush to judgment may be more prevalent there.
Yeah, and like you said, lack of experience. I mean, some of these small communities don't have murders. You know, they haven't seen one in decades, and they don't exactly know how to preserve the crime scene or to do the investigation in a way that, say, people, you know, our police officers, unfortunately, in Chicago are very skilled at. Let's switch gears a little bit, Dr. Johnston. I want to talk about victimology. And when you look at, you know, you've got a crime that gets committed here, a woman is found. We're seeing this, and I think in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, there was a woman found here. There was a woman found there. They're talking about a serial killer. How do you determine whether or not certain murders might be tied to the same perpetrator? Do perpetrators always kind of do the same thing in their crimes? Does it change? And is the victim and who the victim is important in making that assessment?
I think the victim is, you know, tells us as much or more about an offender as anything else. And that just means in terms of, you know, because it tells us so much in terms of not just about her and maybe victim selection, but also in terms of who he's targeting and where he's targeting this person. You know, is this somebody, and I guess the level of risk that he's willing to incur, right? That tells you, I mean, there's just so much about the victim that give us information about the perpetrators. In terms of looking at, are these connected? Obviously, we have DNA now, which is ideal if we can do that to connect crimes. I think separate from that, you do look at victimology and look for patterns in terms of approach, in terms of reduction, in terms of kind of what we call signatures, in terms of is there something psychologically that's being repeated? You know, if you have somebody who is into power and control and they're using binding, for example, they may not, tie everybody up the same way, or they may gag somebody and not gag another person because nobody can hear her, but you'll still see that psychological need being met. And I think that's the tricky thing, is because we do know that people change and they evolve, especially in terms of their MO and actually how they actually do things. But oftentimes that need that they're psychologically satisfying stays pretty much the same.
And I think you'd mentioned in another interview that I heard, you were talking about the Long Island serial killer. And, there's a small area in Long Island where all these women were going missing, many of them sex workers, over a long period of time. It turns out he wasn't just the only serial killer there. There was at least one other one. And they were talking about how there's dismemberment of some of the bodies, some of them not dismembered. And you can't really say this one always dismembers, right? Because you don't, maybe the serial killer does not have the opportunity to do certain things, or is doing things in different ways to dispose of the body.
Exactly. I mean, that is such a good point. Because oftentimes dismemberment is about, it's practical for that person. I mean, that sounds horrible to say.
Of course.
Right, anybody would be dismembered for that reason. But it's kind of a concealment strategy. And so if you have somebody who becomes more confident, they may not do that because they think, well, look, I've gotten away with all these crimes. I don't need to do this anymore. It's too much work. I'll just take them out here and do it.
Right, right. You talked about in another interview about watching interviews with Samuel Little, who is the man who is the most prolific serial killer of murders confirmed. I don't know if it was 90 or something. But tell us what you think about how he got away with it for so many years in 11 different states, and why he was successful and not apprehended sooner.
Yeah, Samuel Little is kind of a horrific example. Well, he's our most prolific, for sure. I think he confessed in 93, and over 50 have been, I think, validated to date. And I think he was, I think, law enforcement's worst nightmare in the sense that he traveled around. So he traveled to many, many different states and murdered in different states. And when he started, of course, there wasn't as much information sharing as going on now. And then he picked, for the most part, what he would consider low-risk victims. I mean, he would target women who had substance abuse problems. He would target sex workers. And so he, picked people who were more difficult to keep track of, and their families sometimes had lost track of them. They didn't know where they were. They were estranged from their families. They had, an ongoing substance abuse problem. And so, it wasn't like he was this mastermind,
yeah.
This criminal mastermind. He just lowered his risk as much as possible by moving around. And he was actually, unfortunately, acquitted of a murder in Florida that he'd been charged with. So he had been arrested many times. He just never was convicted until he finally got caught.
And the idea is that there are fewer serial killers these days. And is it just because people get apprehended sooner because of DNA and cameras and all of that stuff? And whereas they might be a serial killer, they may be one and done. Is that a fair assessment, or is there some other reason that there's fewer serial killers?
Well, I mean, I think, that's a very good theory. And I think that's probably the most prevalent theory, is that there, there's the ones who might have become serial killers are now getting caught after one. I think there's also been some different expressions of violence. I'm not saying that, you know, I've heard many people say, you know, yesterday's serial killers is today's mass shooters. I don't think that's true, because I think there's some differences there. But we do see, you know, kind of certain crimes kind of ebb and flow over time, which is kind of interesting. And so I think that's part of it as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Joni Johnston. I really encourage everyone to get her free Substack newsletter, The Mind Detective, and the book Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask, www.drjoni.com. And I would love for you to come back and talk to us again.